Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Kristen, from the South College Speakers Group, Newark, Delaware.
Hi, I'm Kristen. I'm an alcoholic. I was hoping you guys had more to read. Give me more time. I have a home group at South College Speakers Group in Newark, and I have a sponsor, and I've had the privilege of sponsoring other women. And if this is like your first meeting or you're new and you don't understand like why I say all these things, hopefully by the end you will. And I have a sobriety date, and that's January 28, 2009. So, all right. That date was not my idea. I did not choose that day as, oh, I'm going to be sober. That was a God-appointed day in my life. I hope you can see me. All right. Thank you for asking me to speak and for welcoming me to your group. It's really nice. And when I was new and coming around and I went to my home group now, which is a one-hour speaker meeting, it's intimidating to see all you people, to see all of you with that, you know, sunshine for Jesus kind of smile. And and you're miserable and maybe hungover. And but it's nice. It's nice now that I had a spiritual awakening. So, all right. I hear you guys just had a business meeting, which I love those because when I go back to my home group after the business meeting, you're like recharged with AA life, and it's really nice. So, all right, let's see. I come from a family of alcoholics. My mom's here tonight. and right before this, I actually got to pray with her, which isn't how our relationship was. That's not how I grew up. And, you know, she prayed with me, inviting God in, and I'm waiting God any minute now to come speaking through. But, yeah, so I come from a family of alcoholics. I don't think that's what makes me an alcoholic. I don't think that because I grew up around it, that's why I did what I did. And I wouldn't have said that when I first came in. I would have blamed them. That's very easy. I think it's a very easy thing to do, to blame your family. But, you know, I had to take responsibility. And I had family members who were in recovery, and I had family members who were drinking or who were using for as long as I can remember. So I could see both. I heard about AA. I knew about, like, halfway houses and rehabs and all of that stuff from a very young age. So I knew if I ever did have a problem with it, I knew where I could go. But you have to have some sort of awareness that you have a problem to even know where to go, which I didn't. And so I grew up hearing, you know, a lot of what, like, we share tonight, like our experience, our strength, our hope. I heard that from my family. I heard that from my grandmother. She was a drug and alcohol counselor, and she got sober when my mom was, like, a teenager back in Wisconsin. And she would tell me her experience with alcohol. She would tell me what it did for her. She would tell me about how her kids would have to take the distributor cap off the car so she couldn't drive drunk. Like, I knew about these things. And I knew that she got sober. I knew she got sober through AA. And I knew that when I was a kid that she shared that experience with other people who were struggling. That didn't change anything. that didn't really stop me from doing what I had to do. Because I thought, like, she's given me this message. And what I heard was, if I don't drink, I will never be an alcoholic. That's not what she was saying, but that's what I heard. And so I thought, okay, if I just never drink, I'll never be an alcoholic, but there's something wrong with me now. You know, as a kid, I really felt that there was something wrong with me. And I hear a lot of speakers say that, you know, I was uncomfortable. I was full of fear from a very young age, but I thought that was kind of normal to some extent. I would make myself sick before I would go to school because I didn't want to be around you guys. And I was very miserable. So when I found alcohol, that was a relief. And I kind of had the thought when I started drinking, like, there's no way I could be an alcoholic because alcoholics are supposed to be miserable and I'm having a blast. Like, alcohol gave me something that I just didn't have. And it's like I didn't know how much pain I was living in until the pain stopped. And that was when I first got drunk. That wall between me and you went away. You know how, like, you just, like, some people you just hate, and they're what's wrong with the entire world. Like, drivers, like, who cut you off, and you're like, you're just wrong with everything, and blah, blah, blah. And when I drank, it was like, oh, I am one with you. And why didn't we hang out sooner? And that was my solution, you know? And I think alcohol, provided a solution for me for a little bit, but it's not real. It's a delusion, and it's not sustaining. Let's see. Oh, before I ever started drinking, when I was around 12 years old, I wanted to kill myself. I'd never had a drink at that point. I was sober. It wasn't in my house at that time, and I wanted to die. And I remember I was a cutter for as long as I can remember. My mom said that I used to share that I started cutting when I was about 5. But she, one time when I was done sharing, she was like, you do know that you started doing that at 2. And I was like, I have no idea. But I would, like, have temper tantrums and like, scratch myself. And this I did for forever, I guess. And because I was so uncomfortable in my own skin. And not only that, I could use it to get what I wanted as well. You know, just thinking about me all the time. And so at 12 years old, I start seeing doctors. I start seeing therapists. I start seeing psychiatrists. And there's something has to be wrong with me. And I'm not thinking at that age that it's alcoholism, and I don't think my parents were either, just because it wasn't present in my life. And I start going on a lot of different things. And I figure out real quick that those DSM-4s that diagnose you, if you read those and then you fake those symptoms, like, they'll give you the pills that correspond to that disease. So I did that. I lied, I manipulated, because they gave me something. They gave me a relief. Nothing to which the extent alcohol did later on. But at that point, that's all that I had. And I find that's true with a lot of younger people that come in. It's like, alcohol was not easy for me to get. It wasn't. I did a lot of things to get alcohol, but it was easier for me to get other things. And I did what I could to get out of myself. And that's just my experience. But I loved alcohol. I was in love with it. So I start getting on all these pills, and I start thinking that there's a lot wrong with me, and I start feeling relief from that, to be honest with you. Like, oh, slap a diagnosis on me. Thank God. Because I just can't live this way anymore. Like, I must be crazy. I must be different than all of you. I feel like I'm not fitting in. And then I have, like, these diagnoses, and I have, like, an excuse of why I am the way I am. I have an excuse of why I hate myself every morning. And I'm just kind of wandering aimlessly through life. And I hear a speaker say this, and I love it because it's so true for me. Like, every summer was the summer. Like, I'm gonna lose weight. I'm gonna get my braces off. I'm gonna look better. This school year will be different. I'm gonna feel better. I'm gonna fit in. I'm gonna have friends. And then every year, it just goes down the toilet, and I don't do any of that stuff. And I'm still me. I'm still stuck with me. Like, my closet was, you know, like, skater, punk, preppy, like, I just went through everything just to try to see where I fit in. But when I started drinking, alcohol gave me purpose in my life that I didn't have before. Alcohol took away a lot of my fear that I had of other people, because I needed to go through you to get alcohol. So you see, like, I needed to, I wasn't scared to talk to you if it meant that I could manipulate you, lie to you, and steal it from you to get what what would calm me down, what would make me feel okay, what I thought my solution was. Now, if you had asked me when I was 15, I wouldn't have said all that. I would have just said, I'm just trying to party. I'm just trying to have a good time. I was not ready to hear a message. And 3 months after I started drinking, I ended up in a lovely little psych ward called Rockford for about a month. It was like I was there for so long that they started, like, reusing stuff, like the lesson plans in the morning. And I was like, you've already used that. And they're like, what? You've been here for forever. I was like, oh. And that's when, like, counselors started to introduce the idea that maybe I had a problem. Maybe I had a problem with alcohol. And so the clear answer for somebody at my age was, okay, to get you off my back, I'll stop drinking for a little bit. So for that summer that I got out of the psych ward, I planned on not drinking. And the only way that I knew how to do that was to lock myself in my room for the whole summer. And because I knew, like, there was something inside of me. I couldn't have told you then, but there was something inside of me that knew that if I was around it, I would drink it. that I had no control. But I thought locking myself in my room was control. I thought that was control over alcohol, so clearly I wasn't an alcoholic. And the one time that I did leave my room that summer, I did get drunk. And I was like, whoops. I just changed my mind, you know? No way do I have, like, no mental defense against the first drink. I just wanted to party. And so that school year, I was going to stay sober. It was going to be different this time. And it was, because I got myself a boyfriend, and he was going to just fix everything. And you know what? To be honest, he put in a really good effort. And I mean, to to the point where this guy had training sessions with me to try to teach me how to drink like a lady. And I'm not kidding. And he's not an alcoholic. He's a really nice guy. We're not together anymore, but him and his whole family are really nice, and I still get to talk to them. But we were together for the rest of high school and a little bit, a year or some change after that, and I remember I was sober for the first part of our relationship, and he got to see, you know, a very different person. He fell in love with a very different person than who I became. And I remember one day I was... when I try to stay sober, other things become really important. Schoolwork became very important. You know, if I get this A, I'm going to be okay. If I get into this school, like my ego, like I'll be okay. I will be who I think I'm supposed to be. And this version of me will be happy because I'm just miserable on the inside. And so I dive into my schoolwork. I bring my grades up from the previous semester of drinking and psych ward fun. And I get into this college, my dream college in New York, and I hadn't had a drink, and I have the acceptance letter in my hand, and I'm walking from my school to the parking lot, and it's about like a football field away, and I hear some people talking about senior week. And senior week, if you don't know, is just a week where you just drink, and that's all you do. And to me, if you're an alcoholic, that's all you do. And I hear them talking about senior week, and I haven't had a drink in me in months. I haven't been drinking. And the mental obsession comes in, and I need to drink again. And you know what? I can't even go to school anymore. I should defer a year so that I can learn how to drink appropriately and then have a normal drinking college experience. That sounds good. And so from me leaving my school with my acceptance letter to the parking lot, I had called up my school and deferred a year so that I could learn how to drink. And on my way home, I'm calling my boyfriend, and I'm saying, you're going to teach me how to drink. And he said, okay. So, because he doesn't know what alcoholism is. Poor guy. And so I get this job where his brother has autism, and he's 40 years old, and he lives in a group home next door to where my boyfriend lived. And I was the live-in for that, and I was also the life skills worker. So I would take him and the other members of the house out grocery shopping and to work, and I would be there at night in case anything were to happen. So it's just not a good place for you to be drinking at night by yourself. And so that's what I would do. And I remember he would, like, get, like, really nice wines from France that his parents had and, like, pour it in glasses. And he would explain why we drink out of a glass and not a bottle. And I'm not kidding. Like, I didn't know. And like, why you swirl it. And I don't know. I'd be happy with a box of wine. I don't know. So he's trying to teach me all of this. And the worst thing that would happen is that I'd wake up in the middle of the night. The phenomenon of craving would kick in. I'd pick up another bottle and keep drinking. And he would just take the bottle and bring me back to bed, and that's it. I'm not really suffering any consequences. I'm not, you know, I just get to drink. And he's cutting me off too soon, I think. So I start drinking before the training sessions. And I think, like, if you drink like I do, you don't have any friends. And before I entered into that psych ward, like, I had pushed away most of my friendships at that point. And then, of course, the boyfriend became, like, my higher power, my everything. So I didn't have any friends at this point. It's just me and work and drinking. So I think it's a great idea to try out my newfound drinking skills and to throw a party with all of his friends. And it was just not a good idea. And he invites all of his friends over, and we're drinking. And this is the first time that I really begin to feel that obsession of more, where, like, I'm not enjoying what I'm doing because I'm looking at everybody else's drink going, when are you going to put it down? You know, like, because I need what you have. Like, mine's not enough. It's not going to be enough anymore. And he couldn't watch me that night either, obviously. Like, he's trying to just be a normal drinker and have fun. And so everybody's setting their drinks down, and I'm just following them, and, like, being like the vulture of drinks and taking them. And before I know it, like, I don't know what happened. And after that, he suggested that maybe I just shouldn't drink. And I thought that we should just go on a break. So we took a little break. And actually, he stayed with me for a little bit after that. I don't know why. That night was atrocious. And I kept drinking without him knowing, you know. I would go back to where his brother lived and all these other members of a group home and drink by myself at night. And it got to the point where he would call me and tell me that he's on his way home. And that meant that I had, like, a half hour to an hour to not be drunk. And I just couldn't stop. I remember getting the phone call, and this is, like, at around, like, 3 in the afternoon on a Tuesday. And he's like, I'm going to be home soon. And I was like, okay. And I have beer left over in, like, my mini fridge. And it was just like, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. He'll never know. And just, I drank. And he gets to the door, and I couldn't look him in the eye because I was too drunk, and he just didn't want to look me in the eye. And I kind of thank God that I wasn't at home for this part of my drinking, because I just don't know what my parents would have thought if they had to see this. You know, I know I broke their heart enough, but I can't imagine if they had to live with that. So it was also a blessing. And also, his mother, who was my employer, and their family have shown me more love than I ever did working there. Especially through my amends and how our relationship is today. But we'll get to that. So he's just, like, you know, destroyed. And the next day we are breaking up officially, and he gives me that look of it's just too painful to love you. And I think a lot of alcoholics know that look. And when he gave me that look, I had my hand up to hit him. And that was one of the times where I realized this is what my grandmother was talking about. This is what an alcoholic is. This was what my grandfather did. He was abusive. And I just never thought of it. Like, I'm 5'1". I really didn't take it seriously that I would hit my boyfriend, but I did. You know? I physically hurt him. And that was when he looked at me. And he didn't fight back. He never hit me back. He just kind of, like, ducked his head. And my heart was like, oh, my gosh. This is who I am. I'm a monster. So after that, I didn't stop drinking. I didn't know how to stop drinking, you know. And I didn't think that was the problem. I just thought it was me. I thought I was crazy. I thought all these pills and all this other stuff just wasn't working for me anymore. And everybody else is the problem. My life is the problem. I needed to go to college. That was the problem, or what have you. Anything but what, you know, but alcoholism. I kind of thought, I was like, everyone in my family is an alcoholic, so if I were one, I would know. Thank you. And I couldn't see it. I couldn't see it. And at this time, I had tried AA. I forgot to mention that. When I was about 16, my cousin Sarah was getting sober. She was 4 years older than me. We both started drinking around the same time, and she ended up getting sober down in Florida and moving back up here. And when I was 16, she tried to take me to a few meetings. And I thought that she just really wanted to hang out with me. You know, come on, Kristen, come hang out. And I'm like, oh, gosh, I'm so busy. Why does she keep calling? I know I'm fun. But that wasn't what was going on. What was going on, if you haven't figured it out yet, is that she had a living amends to me, and that was to be there in case I ever wanted what she had, in case I ever wanted to get sober, in case I ever need help. And I remember a few times I got drunk, and she would come pick me up, or she would talk to me on the phone. And she never, I don't ever remember her shoving AA down my throat. I don't ever remember her even, I remember her big book being on the table, but she never opened it until I wanted it. She just was there. And so this time around, after, you know, I end up in another psych ward. I feel like that's my thing, psych wards. I'm really good in them. I love psych wards. And so I go to another psych ward, I'm thinking it's about time again. And I remember feeling like, this is okay. If like every few years I need to go to a psych ward to get like a tune-up and then I can keep drinking, I'll be okay with that. But that's not how alcoholism works. It's progressive. And it wasn't going to be like that. It was just going to get worse and worse and worse. So I go into another psych ward, and I want to die again. I'm suicidal. I can't stand being in my own skin. My skin is crawling, and I'm sober. Ugh, that sucks. And I'm sitting there in the waiting room, and I'm trying to kill myself in the waiting room. I don't know what to do. It's not that I particularly wanted to die. I was just out of ideas. And when I run out of ideas, I can't ask for help. I think death is an option. Death becomes a really good option when I run out of ideas. And I don't have, you know, I can't pocket my pride long enough to ask anybody for help. So, but I'm in the psych ward at that point. So, you know, that stops. And I lie, and I'm in, you know, or I get this point of desperation in the psych ward where for the, you know, one of the first times in my life, I feel a presence of God in my life when I called out to him. And that went away the next day, and I wanted out of the psych ward, and I lied, I manipulated, I told the doctors what they needed to hear, and they let me out. And the ride home from that psych ward to my house where my cell phone was so long because I needed to get that phone, so I need to call my friend to get booze because that's what was going to make me okay. And I get there, and I call my friend, and she's on her way over, and my cousin, who's in the program, knows I'm out. She knows I'm free, and she calls me, and I'm like, oh, of course she wants to hang out. And I answer the phone, and she's like, hey, how are you? Do you want to come to a meeting with me tomorrow morning? And I'm not a morning person today. And so then it was like, no. I got up at, you know, 3 in the afternoon. And I was shaking my head no. Like, how dare she even ask me? And the words yes came out. Thank God, you know. My heart was like, Kristen's head, you're done. Stop. And I'll take it from here. And I hung up the phone telling myself, I'm going to call her back. I'm going to call her back. I'm going to cancel. I'm going to have a real good excuse. And I never called her back. My friend came over, and something different happened that night because we drank, she fell asleep, and I didn't get drunk. I drank and drank and drank, and I just didn't get drunk. Nothing happened, and I'm stuck with my own thoughts. And, you know, I drank for effect. And when the alcohol's not working, that's just a horrible place to be. I didn't know how to put it down, and I couldn't live without it. And our book talks about that. And I didn't know that the train, you know, like that train has already been set in motion, that God was already on its way. You know, the solution was already coming to my door tomorrow morning. And that night, I remember saying the Serenity Prayer over and over and over again. Because if you grow up in an AA household, you definitely know the Serenity Prayer. And it got to the point where I just, like, shortened it, like, courage, wisdom, strength, and just say that over and over again. And I asked God to either kill me or just change my entire life completely because I can't do it. And God changed my entire life completely. but I was so arrogant, I gave God an ultimatum. I think of it now. But the point was is that I reached out to a God that night. And that wasn't the first time that I reached out to a God, and it wasn't the first time that God had tried to help me. But it was the first time that I listened. It was the first time that I was desperate enough to listen. So I didn't fall asleep at all that night. And she comes to pick me up. And I don't know if I should say it, but I was a new girl in AA. And so I had blonde hair and, like, black roots. And I think it's a great idea to wear, like, short shorts and, like, a low top to an AA meeting. And and I smelled like tequila. I'd been up all night. And that's what I looked like when I came in. So I'm really proud today when I can look presentable. I really like that. I really like that speakers look nice. They put on ties. They wear, you know, high heels and just are presentable because I didn't know how to do that. You know, I just looked like I was caught in a drain. And I don't take credit for who you see here today. Like, this is God, that I can look respectable and that I can look like a woman. And because I, you know, I'm a woman and I can manipulate and use what I got to get what I need to get. And I don't do that today. So I have a pride in myself because I can see God within me today that I didn't have before. I didn't have self-respect before. I didn't think either I thought I was, you know, the most beautiful woman ever and all of you were ugly, or I just thought I was the ugliest person ever and I'd never be any good at all. And today I just know that I'm right sized as a child of God, and I'm equal with all of you. And it's just beautiful to see God in everybody else and to see it in me as well. That's pretty awesome. So anyways, that's how I looked when I came to my first meeting. And my cousin picked me up, and she's taking me, and I'm just going on and on and on about this breakup. And I'm like, how am I going to get him back? And, you know, how am I going to get my job back? Blah, blah, blah. How am I going to get money? How am I going to go to school? And just all about me, 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 and all these things that I think are going to fix me. And so she picks me up, and we go to this meeting. It's right down. It's actually like I can walk to it now from where I live. And I go in, and there weren't a lot of younger people there. But to be honest, when you're dying of alcoholism, I didn't see age, I didn't see gender, I didn't see race. I was dying. I didn't notice that. Well, and I was also self-centered. I was thinking about me and how I look. So, so I get to the meeting, and these women and a couple women were talking about the economy in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I didn't relate. I didn't fit in. I didn't want what you had. And just then I was like, or my cousin turns to me and she's like, my sponsor will be here soon. She's running late. And that's what she was planning on doing. She was going to hook me up with somebody who could give me the solution because she knew that she couldn't. You can't really 12-step a family member. I've tried myself. She was just going to put me in the hands of her sponsor. She was just going to show me what worked for her. Which if you haven't gotten it, that's the whole point of AA, is you just share your experience and it helps somebody else. And so her sponsor walked through the door, and she was late. And I don't know about you, but that meant so much to me because I could never be late. I was always like a half hour early everywhere because I was so scared that if I were late, like I'd walk in and everybody would, you know, turn heads and like look at me and be like, oh, my God, she's late. I bet you she's a horrible person, which nobody ever thinks that, but I think that about me. So she was late, and she came in with this ease about herself that I never known before. And I couldn't see it in my cousin. I couldn't see it in anybody else in that meeting. But I think God helped me see it that day in her. And she sat down next to me, and she was calm. She could sit for an hour. She wasn't fidgeting, all these things that I couldn't do. But I couldn't do for a while in sobriety. I was up and down, fidget, play with my thumbs. And she could do that. So I was really impressed already. She didn't even have to open her mouth. And after the meeting, I wanted what she had, but I didn't have the guts to ask her for it. And she had the same experience that I did, so she went up to me, and she talked to me, because I was just so painfully shy. And she said, you should take my number. And I was like, oh, no, I see where this is going. I don't want to do that. No, thank you. And but what I said was, you know what? I'll get your number later from somebody else. And she was like, no, why don't you take it now? And I was like, rats, she caught me. And so I open my phone and I take down her number. And she leaves and she knows, which, you know, she took my number as well. That's where they get you. So they take your number. And so she goes home. And my cousin's taking me home, and I'm going on and on and on again about the boyfriend and the job and all this other stuff. And she turns to me, and, like, I could hear it in her voice that she is tired of listening to my problems. And she just goes, why don't you give it up to God? And I was like, like, I had no idea that that was an answer. I just didn't know. I just thought that, like, I had to run my own life, and I just wasn't doing a good job. I had no idea that there was a higher power available to me. And on that day, I knew. I was like, oh, my God. And then I asked her, I was like, what are the 12 steps? Just out of curiosity. Not that I wanted to do them or anything. And she says them out of memory. And I'm like, oh, you're lame. You go to a lot of meetings. You haven't memorized. And she... But what I hear is God. I didn't know that before. When I was 16 and I was coming around, I didn't see God. I didn't read those. I didn't hear God. And it's not that you weren't telling me. Like, I'm blessed enough that all the times that I come to AA, I heard a message of hope, and not everybody gets that. In fact, I think it's really rare that people come to AA and hear the solution. But I did, because those women that were there when I was 16 are still there now, and they were still talking the same solution. I just didn't hear it. I didn't hear God. But in that day, when she told me that this was a spiritual solution to my problem, that was what I wanted. I felt like I had discovered it, you know? God, like, tricked me. Oh, I know what it is. It's God. Like, I figured it out. And I was just so relieved, because the doctors weren't doing anything for me, because I could lie to them. They couldn't see through me when I had just tried to kill myself, and they just released me. My faith in them failed a long time ago. The meds weren't working for me anymore. They were making me feel sick. I felt shaky all the time. I didn't feel comfortable in my own body. And I had faith in a lot of things to get me okay. And alcohol was the last thing, and it stopped working. So when she said God, I had this renewed hope that it was going to be okay. And when I found out that AA was going to get me to God, I wanted it. And that's a good place to be. And I don't hide that. I used to kind of be scared when I was new and I had just gone through the steps to tell you that God was my solution, because I did have problems with God. I didn't want to say God. I didn't want to sound like, you know, all the judgments that I had about religion before. I didn't want to sound like that. But none of that was real. You know, this is. The fact that I'm alive today is real. And that's proof for me that was God. So anyways, I was shocked when she said that to me, and I was relieved. And I go home and I Google the 12 steps, because I'm still not quite, you know, putting my pride away and long enough to actually talk to another human being about it. So I Google the 12 steps and enter, and I see all of them, and then I see, okay, I could do that one. Okay, all right, I can do that one. I can do that one. The only one that you technically need another person, in my mind, is the fifth step. And so what I did was I replaced that with canine, and I told my dog everything. So I just, like, I went through, check, 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 and then, like, I picked up my dog. I was like, all right, God. And I put up, and she's a little chihuahua. And I was like, you know, I guess I did some bad stuff with my ex-boyfriend, and, you know, and that was it. And I think it was at that point that my first sponsor, Anna, that she called me. and it arranged to meet up with me. And if you're new and if somebody calls you and says you want to go to a meeting, that means they're going to take you through 1, 2, and 3. And that's what she did. She called me. She was like, okay, let's go to a meeting, but first let's get coffee. And I got sober in a coffee shop. I don't know about you, but that's where I got sober. And she had a big book. She gave me a big book. We chain-smoked cigarettes. We drank black coffee and espresso. And the book was open, and I can't tell you everything that was said, but I know it was the language of the heart. And I know that God was brought in on it. And I know that she prayed with me. And I know that she told me to read the book by myself, and I did. But when I read it by myself, I didn't understand a word of it. But I know now that was willingness enough, that I opened that book, that I sat down with that book. And now I still do that to this day. I read a couple pages a day. And but she would go through it with me. I think it's very dangerous to leave an alcoholic by themselves with that book, because they might do a fist up with their dog. So she took me through the 12 steps, and, well, first of all, after the third step, I don't know if it's terribly effective for me to go through each one with you, because I've had so many experiences with them. But the point is that I did it, and I did it with another alcoholic who had an experience with it. But after my third step, I realized, like, I was driving home, and I remember the whole way home, I'm poking my cheeks. I'm like, something's wrong with my cheeks. They don't feel right. And when I get home, there's like a mirror on my hallway, and I'm walking up the stairs, and I look, and I realize I've been smiling. And I was like, holy cow! Like, I didn't know what that was. I had a grump on my face for like 5 years. And so I thought, wow, if the first three steps can do that, I'm good. I'm not going to do any more steps. I only needed three. Thanks. Bye. And I know that I'm certain that she even went over that part in the book that says you can have a really good feeling with this third step, but it's not going to last if you don't do the fourth step. and the fact that it says next and at once we do the fourth step. I'm sure she read that to me. Again, I didn't hear it. Just missed that part. So I'm like, okay, I'm not a really severe alcoholic. All of you might need all 12, but I just need 3. I'm going to say this prayer every day, and life's going to be great. So I start to do that, and within 2 weeks, I would say, I was crazier than what I was on the psych ward about a month ago, you know? I was just nuts. And my cousin, who's living with me at the time, who's sober, she tells me, I was like, Sarah, I really think there's something wrong with me. Like, I'm not getting this. I'm crazy. I think I need to go back into the hospital. And she was like, or do a fourth step. And I was like, oh. And I don't know why, but it made sense coming out of her mouth. And I just turned around. We were in the hallway between both of our rooms. She said, do a fourth step. And I was like, okay. And I turned around. I went in my room. I sat down and did a fourth step. I prayed. I did it right out of the big book. It took me maybe 2 hours. I think it took me more like an hour, but I think I round up just in case. And I say this because it was my experience. I had about 5 resentments that were blocking me off from God then. I couldn't feel God then from those resentments. And if I were to have to sit there and think about, you know, little Jimmy in preschool and what he did to me, I wouldn't be here today. Like, I had to get to God. I had to get to God now, and those few things were what was blocking me off. And later, when I was sober longer, things came back to my memory that I could write down, and that I could clear, and that I could make right. But God only gives me what I can handle, and those were the only things that I could handle at that time. Could you imagine if, you know, like a month sober, and I had to deal with every resentment I've ever had? Whoa, that's a lot. And so I go to her, I have about 5 resentments, I have my fears list, which was important for me to realize that this selfishness is all based on fear. My whole life is based on fear. And my perception is starting to change because she had me write out my fourth column. I don't know if anybody else did that. I've heard other people haven't had to do that, and they write it out with their sponsor. But she had me write it out where I flipped over the page. And I asked God to come in, and I wrote out where I was selfish, where I was dishonest, where I was self-seeking, where I was frightened. And from that frightened, I wrote my fears list. And from that, I went over my sex inventory. And, you know, it wasn't perfect. I'm sure there was, like, gigantic stuff that I was missing. But it was good enough. It was good enough that, you know, my sponsor kind of pointed out a few things during the fifth step. But I remember after doing my fifth step, oh, and that's another thing. Like, the second my fourth step was done, I called my sponsor. She was ready. I don't know what she had to do that day. I don't know if she was at work or what, but she came to me. Like, it was done, and I can't thank her enough for that. I do my fifth step, and I go to we go to a meeting afterwards, and everyone can see a physical change in me. And now I can see it. Now that I've been sober a little bit, and I see people, like, when they come in, and then I can tell when they've done a fifth step. I'm like, oh, my God, did you see them? Did you see how good they look? Like, they're shining, and they're bubbly, and they're excited, and they can look the world in the eye, as our book talks about. And I could do that. And I'm getting all these compliments. I'm like, oh, thanks. A fifth step. And so I do my fifth step. I go to a meeting, and again, I just don't think 6 and 7 are for me. But anyway, so I get to the point where, like, I balk at every single step. So you don't have to. I already did that. It doesn't work. I had pain between each and every single step. And, you know, nuts. And, you know, she took me through 10, 11, and 12, and I remember I feel like it was really dramatic. In my head, it was really dramatic. But she, like, slammed the big book closed and then, like, pushed it across the table towards me and was like, now you go. I don't think that's how it happened, but that's how it happened in here. And I'm like, I can't sponsor people. You know, I'm not like a real bad alcoholic that, you know, I can help people. You know, I'm just here for me. And I just, you know, sad to say, like, I really did think of AA like that for a while. After having a spiritual experience, was that it was here just for me. this experience was just here for me. That's why AA was made, was for, you know, Kristen to get sober. And I moved to New York. I ended up going to that school after I went through all 12. She got me through the 12 steps before I went to college because that's the solution. And it wasn't about time. It wasn't about waiting or anything like that. I just needed the solution before I went into college. And she did that for me. And I go to New York and I don't help people. I don't think I'm qualified. And I think that because I'm in New York, my sponsor's not going to know about it, so it's going to be okay. And I don't need to help people. And I lose it, you know. I relapsed, and it wasn't on alcohol, but it was on something where I took it to get it out of my head, and I didn't feel right sitting up here telling you that that was my sobriety date, you know. And that was in January. I was home from winter break, and I did another four step because I thought something else was wrong. But the problem is that I wasn't helping people. That was the problem, but I still want to work on me. I need to do another fourth step. I need to do five more 10 steps because I want to talk about me. I want to make it all about me. And that's not it. The point is to help other people, to get you blocked off, to help somebody else. That's where the solution is. And so I'm doing a million fourth steps, and I'm sure my sponsor was just like, oh, wow, another inventory. And and so that night before I moved back to New York, because I was home on break, I took something, and that was when I got the message, oh, I'm not God-dependent. I am still Christian-dependent, and I can become God-dependent by helping other people. It was very loud and clear for some reason. And that day, that was the last time that I used. And I went to New York, and a lot of people there, you know, I tried. A lot of people were like, oh, you're too young. I don't want you to sponsor me. And I would call my cousin. I'm like, I need to help somebody. What do I do? What do I do? And she was like, sponsor your roommate. My roommate's not an alcoholic, but I took her through the steps. And I, to this day, like she is, and everyone who came with us knows her, Caitlin. She's like our AA mascot. And like, she knows about the big book. She let me talk about this with her. She's come to open meetings with me. And she's just great. And we've stayed friends. Hi Caitlin. I'm thinking of you. And, she'll ask me tonight. She'll be like, I know you were at a speaker's meeting, right? What did you talk about? She's cute. And, so that was what I did, is I tried to help. I tried to help any way that I could. You know, if people were saying I was too young to sponsor them, you know, like, oh, well, try another meeting, you know? Like, I was told I have an experience with alcoholism. I have an experience with the 12 steps, and that's good enough. It doesn't matter about my age. It doesn't matter if I'm a girl or whatever. Like, I have a solution, and it worked for me. I go to New York, and something's not sitting right with me anymore about New York, you know? God's trying to put me on a different path and I'm resisting, and that just feels awful when you do that, and I can't sleep at night anymore, and I'm like, what's going on? And in meditation, I remember I got real clear, move home. And I was like, nah. And like immediately after I like denied that, life started to get real bad real quick. And I was like, okay, fine, I'll do it. I'll take this leap of faith one more time. It's not like you haven't proven yourself to me before. And I go home. And my cousin, I didn't have enough money for school. Was really expensive there, and I didn't have enough money. And she was going to give me a loan to go back to school. She's going to give me like $7,000, and I was going to take it. And then it wasn't sitting right with me. It didn't feel right. And she told me she was getting a divorce, and I told her I couldn't take it. I was like, I can't take this from you. And I thought that that was the right thing. And I didn't know at that time what this year was going to bring and why I needed to be home and why that wasn't the right thing. Because, of course, you know, I've been taught, like, if somebody wants to give me a gift, I can take it. And on any other day, if she was going to give me that loan, like, I would have taken it. And it would have come from her heart, and it would have been the right thing to do. But because I have a God of my own understanding, and I know that I know nothing, that because that didn't feel right, I trusted that and I didn't accept it. The day that I was supposed to move back to New York, my two-year anniversary, my dad went into the hospital with heart failure. And I'm a daddy's girl to this day. And he would make me breakfast in bed every day before school. And I love him. And when he got sick like that, that had never happened before. And I didn't go to God when that happened. The first day that happened, I didn't go to God. I was like, I'm just going to sit here and wait until the doctor tells me that everything's going to be okay. And that's not the response that we got. You know, we got the response like, this isn't good. And I was like, I have no other choice but to go to God. Isn't God so nice? Isn't God nice that I can repeatedly choose not to go to God, and then God will be there when I'm like, okay, fine. And I go to God, and of course the message is, it's not about you. It's about helping other people. And so I cry every day on the way to the hospital. And when I get there, I watch Jeopardy with him. I play board games with him. And I cry every day on my way home from the hospital. And 2 weeks later, he comes home. And he's fine now. But I yell at him about his diet. And but I love him. But I wouldn't, like, that was a gift of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wouldn't know to look for that back when I was drinking. I wouldn't know that that was where the gift is. That me with my dad on those 2 weeks in the hospital, it meant more to me than anything else. And I didn't know that it would. I think that's important to know, that what you think will make you happy doesn't, and the last thing you think will make you happy does. So he comes home from the hospital, and shortly after that, my cousin who was in, who had about 5 years, started drinking again. And it was because, you know, she didn't turn to God. And I saw it happen. I think it happens in seconds and inches in here, people leaving. Like, I didn't just, you know, help other people and pray every day and then wake up and go out. It's that along the line, I start making choices that put something between me and God, and I slowly step out of AA. And that's what happened to her. And I saw it happen for years. It was happening. She starts drinking again. And I'm like, that's it. I'm angry with her. You know, she's my family. She's supposed to be sober. Like, she was there when I got sober, and I'm not going to talk to her. And I'm not sleeping at night anymore. It's not sitting right with me. And I know that that means I need to go to God, that I'm not doing something, and I need to owe her an amends. Just like she had with me when I was drinking. You know, those times that she would pick me up drunk and talk to me and be there for me. Well, I had to do that for her. And it's not easy. If anybody in here has a family member who's drinking and you're sober, you know that it sucks. It sucks to watch them do that. But because I have God, that relationship is different. It's not about me. And it's a miracle. My relationship with her has been a miracle because I had a few good moments with her. Before school started, I found her in her car in the middle of the night trying to kill herself. And I held her and told her it was going to be okay. And she went into the hospital. And a week after that, she did kill herself. And, man, that was... I didn't see that coming. She was there for me when I came in. And after she died, I had to go to God. I didn't have a choice. You know, it was a very real possibility of drinking again. I don't want anybody to not know that the grief is hard, and that choosing a drink at that time, you know, I would expect an alcoholic to choose a drink at that time and not God. But it's a miracle that I did choose God. And I sat down outside to smoke a cigarette, and her 24-hour day book was there. And I open it up, and the front page falls out, it was a message from her to me that she wrote when she gave it to me. And she said, you are never alone. And I knew things were going to be okay. And it hasn't been an easy road. I want to make that clear, that this is the first time I've ever lost somebody really close to me. And it's not an easy road. And if you're going through it, I'm sorry. It's not easy. And to this day, I still come up with, you know, things that I really need to go to God with. And I've grown a lot in this program because of that. But I stay here for her. My first home group was called Doorkeepers because the women are said to, like, stay by the door for the newcomer that's just coming in or the one that just wants to run out before the meeting ends so we can grab them. And that's what she did for me, and that's what I do today. The solution for my grief, the solution for all of that, was in the Big Book. I didn't find it anywhere else, and believe me, I looked. I really thought, this is going to be the thing that's different. I've lost somebody. None of you know what that's like, really. And the solution was in the big book. The solution was helping other women. And do you know how many people I've helped since then that have lost somebody? A lot. And I got to share that with other people. And other people got to share that with me. And AA got to be there for me. AA put on her memorial service. The church was packed with people because of her, because of her short time in AA and all the women that she got to help. And I don't doubt that she didn't have a great life. Well, I didn't smudge anything, so that's good. And I know that she's up there right now and that she's here with me tonight. And I can't stop thinking about her when I look out on all of you people who have the same disease that she had, the same disease that I have, and we all have one solution. And if anybody doesn't have that, grab somebody. Like, don't sell yourself short. Sometimes I feel like that was when I was 16 and I came in and all I could do was just hold on. It was because my brain could not fathom a life beyond my wildest dreams. And it really couldn't. It could only comprehend me being miserable. And thank God I put aside my ego and my pride so I could get this. And who you see today is not who I was. And please, just if you don't hear anything else that I said, grab another alcoholic who's been through the 12 steps and go through this book. I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you for letting me share.